Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Can our assumptions about future events in our own lives make them come true? Doctors have long recognized the curious phenomenon of the placebo effect, whereby patients' health will sometimes improve if they believe a drug will help them, even if the pill they are given has no medicinal value. But as my guest today has learned, our brain's keen focus on what might happen next in our lives has a deep impact far beyond medicine, so that the outcomes we anticipate in school, in sports, even at the dinner table, will sometimes come to fruition, at least in part because we believe they will. Science journalist Chris Burdick is a former staff editor at The Atlantic and at Mother Jones. His new book is called Mind Over Mind, The Surprising Power of Expectations. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So much of the power of expectations comes from the fact that human brains spend a lot of their time predicting the future. And in fact, this need might explain why we're so good at remembering the past?
Yeah, well, I think so. I think a lot of memory researchers have come around to the idea that memory may be a the reason why we have memory may not be to kind of flip through a photo album in our heads of past experiences, but to actually collect the raw material for some of the expectations that we bring to bear on our experiences.
Can you tell us about common coding theory and why it matters so much?
Okay, yeah, sure. Common coding theory is an idea of how we practice learned physical movements. So it's an idea that when you are practicing a, let's say, how to catch a baseball, what you learn is, what you are anticipating is where that ball is going to end up, where the catch will be made. And that forward model, they call it, in your head, then coordinates all the requisite movements so that you can have your glove in the right place at the right time.
Hmm. So we're thinking in those situations a split second ahead, but that split second is important.
That split second is very important. Oftentimes it is seen as what is the foundation of athletic expertise. So oftentimes there'll be an exhibition where a fast pitch softball pitcher will come out, say at the All-Star game in the majors, and proceed to strike out all the major league sluggers. And the reason why this happens is because the major leaguers know how to pick up the cues from the major league pitchers and anticipate where the pitch will be a split second before it happens. And they can't pick up the cues on the fast pitch softball players because the pitching windup is entirely different.
So you open the book with an account of Franz Anton Mesmer in the 18th century, whose exploration of animal magnetism was like the talk of Paris for a while. Talk about what he did and why he was seen as such a threat to power at the time.
Sure. Well, he was a healer, and he healing mechanism, he believed, was to tap into the cosmic essence, and he described it as essentially, he called it animal magnetism or magnetism. And this was apparently, you know, he said magnetism and gravity are these immense forces. They rule the cosmos. Why can they not essentially rule our organs and vital tissues? And he then claimed that he could kind of rebalance. If you had an illness, it was because you were out of balance, and that he could rebalance you. He started by using magnets themselves and touching patients with them. Then he would just use his hand gestures to kind of maneuver the energy. And so people would come to his clinic, and they would sit there, and he would come out resplendent in a lilac robe with all sort of celestial symbols on it, and he would wave his hand in front of them and stare into their eyes. And people would start to essentially have, I don't call them seizures, but they would begin to flail about and kind of have coughing fits, and they called it the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be led away into a side chamber. They would come out after they had calmed down, and they would pronounce themselves much better. That they felt much better. Whatever had been ailing them, they felt much better. So he was first a threat to the physicians of the time. The actual they were all members of the sort of Royal Academy of Physicians, who saw his method as, you know, pure hocus pocus. He wasn't, you know, they used to, the physicians of the time would would put leeches on people and bleed them and just give people purgatives and enemas and things like that.
Nobody's going to want to be bled anymore if this guy keeps up.
Exactly. So they said, no, this is nonsense. And a number of them were highly connected in the royal court. They convinced the king to launch a commission, which was led by none other than Ben Franklin, actually. And this is the sort of origin of the placebo-controlled experiment, because Ben Franklin's commission essentially tricked patients of the magnetists, of the magnetic healers, into thinking that they were being magnetized, into thinking that they were receiving these treatments when they weren't, and then they would produce the same effects that Mesmer and the healers that he had trained would produce. So they wrote a report to the king about this, and they claimed, you know, this is all bunk. This is all driven by imagination, and furthermore, imagination is dangerous.
Hmm.
Imagination, you know, this is when they kind of deviated from debunking Mesmer and even from health, and they just started saying things like, you know, imagination is the fomenter of rebellion, and imagination is a corrupter of morals, and, you know, imagination is, and these ill effects are contagious. So it kind of was saying, you know, this is not only a quack, but a threat to your kingdom.
And so here in the 21st century, we continue to have evidence that imagination is really important for people, even for things like these balance bracelets that were sold a few years ago.
Sure. And in this case, balance bracelets, they sold millions of them for $30 a piece, and they had a cadre of really well-known athletes testifying to them. They were part of the Power Balance team that would be on the website. And it apparently worked in a similar way to animal magnetism via a hologram on the Power Balance bracelet that would rebalance your energy and therefore improve your strength and endurance. So finally, some researchers started putting it to the test and actually having people wear placebo Power Balance bracelets and giving them the same routine of strength and endurance tests, and lo and behold, there was no difference. Eventually, last year, Power Balance lost a class action lawsuit and had to settle for $57 million, I believe. So, you know, people did improve. People did feel a benefit from these Power Balance bracelets, but you know, holograms had nothing to do with it.
So it was really that sense that they could do these things, and they kind of unlocked abilities that they probably already had but didn't have confidence in.
That's a lot of it, yes. And part of it is often when people are, you know, in an athletic contest, and you know, they have anxiety, which can disrupt that anticipation that we were talking about from common coding theory, that is a vital part of performing well in athletics. It can also be a basic distraction in certain cases where focus is much more important. And when you have a Power Balance bracelet, when you have some kind of maybe a placebo pill or anything that is kind of, you think is, has got your back, it is a confidence booster. It is an anxiety reducer, and therefore, you know, it lifts your performance that way. So that's one of the ways.
And, you know, it's funny. It's our instinct is to bristle against this sort of thing and say, well, it's nonsense. But for a lot of people, it works.
Yeah, a lot of people, it does work. And I don't want to oversell it, because all these effects are quite conditional.
Mm-hmm.
They don't always go in, you know, they're not unidirectional,
right.
But when they do happen, they can have some very real and some very powerful effects.
Okay, so Chris, let's talk about the other direction, because there is the ability to sort of really fire on all cylinders when we're under pressure, and then there is also the tendency that some of us have to choke under pressure. What does that have to do with expectations?
Well, it's basically, I talk about it as choking under pressure is expectations eating their young. the reason I say that is that oftentimes you choke when the expectations for your success are the highest. I mean, that's almost a definition of choking. If nobody expects you to do well and you don't do well, that's not choking. But the case study I look at are the British soccer players, who are among the best soccer players in the world. The league that they play in is the best in the world. They're extremely highly paid. They are beloved by millions of people, and they routinely choke under pressure. When they get together as a national team, it's sort of a deadly mix of extremely high expectations for the team and a sort of undercurrent of how are they going to blow it this time. So, and they usually blow it at the penalty spot. They have a horrible record when it comes to converting penalty kick shootouts, which sometimes decide games in big tournaments. So that is, you know, and I talked to a researcher that studies, he studies choking under pressure, but his favorite subject is English penalty kickers.
So we think a lot, you know, when our team has the home field advantage, that this is a great thing. But it turns out that that's not necessarily the boost that we believe it is.
Yeah, and this is one of those cases where, you know, most of the time it is a boost. It's when you have, like with the English soccer players, this kind of a high expectation for victory and a concomitant worry about disappointing those expectations. In the lab, you know, this has been shown with people that are playing a video game for money, and they have certain targets they have to meet. One is a easy target, one is a challenging target, and they are doing it either without an audience or with a friendly audience who will share their prize if they win, or a hostile audience who will get the prize if they fail. And they do much better in front of the hostile audience. And the idea is that people know when they're being watched by someone who expects them to win, and they try too hard not to fail rather than trying to win. So it's not, like I said, this is not something that, you know, I think we should all cheer for our home team. by and large, the home field advantage is a real thing. But just to see that it can happen. And the English soccer players are my case in point.
So how significant is the impact of previous successes or failures on how we perform the next time we're under pressure in a similar situation?
It seems to be quite important. Now, this is a difficult one because this comes to the question of the hot hand, which is a way of talking about the idea that, say, a basketball player can get hot. And so that once the basketball player has hit two or three shots in a row, he's more likely, you know, pass him the ball because he's more likely to hit the next one because of the previous success. Now, this is a theory that a lot of players and a lot of fans have. It was put to the test statistically about 20 years ago, where all the shots of a team over an NBA team, the Sixers, they were looked at over an entire season. And they had statistics on what shots were made and what shots were missed. And they found out that, in fact, if you made two shots in a row, you were more likely to miss the next shot than you were if you had missed the previous two shots. So over the long run, statistically, the hot hand doesn't exist. But in the discrete moment of a particular game, one could argue that it does, and that's hard to prove because it's hard to attack that statistically.
Chris Burdick is with us. He's a science journalist who's just written a book called Mind Over Mind, The Surprising Power of Expectations. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist Chris Burdick. He's a former staff editor at The Atlantic and at Mother Jones, and now he's got a book out called Mind Over Mind, The Surprising Power of Expectations. Join this conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Chris, I was really interested in the research about how all of this might influence healthy habits and self-control. Brain scans show different activity in people who chose snacks for their health value as opposed to their taste. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was. That study was great because it speaks to the question of how we think about craving and how we think about self-control. Oftentimes, we think about self-control as the ability to say no to our cravings, the ability to tamp down on them and shut them down. But cravings, wanting in the brain, is not all id. Our reward circuits are activated by some of the, you know, visceral things, like a good candy bar or money. But they are also activated by some more kind of abstract ideas like discovery or mastery. These things also can become, you know, reward center activated goals. So in this study, they had people looking at various snacks, and they rated them in terms of healthiness and taste. And then they did a second round where they had people select one of these foods for a potential snack, and they said, well, we're going to pick one of them that you choose, and you're going to have to eat it, or we're going to serve it to you anyway. So people would rate these foods against one another as they were having their brain scanned. And some people, the people that they eventually labeled self-controllers, took into account the healthiness rating of the foods that they were judging. That influenced the reward circuit activity, not just the taste rating. It was sort of, they did this by looking at the correlation of what they had previously rated the foods. And the people that had no self-control, they were only influenced by the taste. If it was yummy, they went for that. So it was sort of a question of, can you make better choices by harnessing wanting of a different kind rather than simply shutting down, you know, the hedonistic wanting part of your brain?
So you don't just shut down the desire for Cool Ranch Doritos, you amp up the desire for healthy carrots and celery.
Yeah, exactly. Or you amp up the desire for what eating healthy carrots and celery gets you, which is, you know, to feel healthier or to be able to fit into the genes that you bought, or, you know, whatever goal it is, to focus on that goal as an object of desire rather than to simply focus on the self-denial of not eating the Doritos.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Leslie in Southlake on the phone. Hi, Leslie. Leslie, hi, are you with us? Okay, maybe later we will get another call from Leslie. Talk about this, Chris. How could placebo calories fill us up?
Yeah, so this again speaks to wanting as distinct from liking. I'll talk about a study, and then we can kind of discuss what it means. There was a British study where they had people come in after not eating for 3 hours. They came into the lab, and they were going to have a strawberry banana smoothie. And prior to drinking their smoothie, they were shown all the ingredients. Some people saw a heaping pile of bananas and strawberries, and other people saw a much smaller pile of, you know, actually not even a pile, just a little plate of bananas and strawberries, and then they were taken away back into the kitchen and the smoothies were made. Now, in fact, everybody got the same amount of bananas and strawberries in their smoothie. They then rated, before they drank it, they rated how full and fulfilling they expected the smoothie to be, and then they went off for 3 hours where they were supposed to not eat anything and report back on how they were doing in terms of hunger.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that the people who saw the big plates of fruit expected to feel more fulfilled after eating, drinking their smoothie, which makes sense. But then again, for 3 hours, they continued to feel more full and less hungry than the people that had seen the smaller plate. This actually then in a next study was shown to have effects on metabolism and some of the neuropeptides that kind of drive hunger. This was a milkshake study where people all got it a same milkshake, but some people were told it was an indulgent 600-calorie chocolate shake, and other people were told it was a Sensa shake that was only 90 calories or something, a diet shake, essentially. I think in reality it was a 200-calorie shake. And they then measured, before and after eating the shake, the blood levels of a peptide called ghrelin, which is produced in the stomach and makes its way to the brain and essentially triggers the brain to send out the signal, I'm hungry.
Mm-hmm.
More ghrelin means I'm hungry. And as you eat, the ghrelin production stops or slows down and your hunger abates. And so the ghrelin levels followed the expectations based on whether they thought they were drinking an indulgent shake or a Sensa shake, a diet shake. So that is it. You know, the expectations of calories, you know, not every calorie is created equal, and expectations of calories can have some of the very same perception and in terms of, you know, metabolism, real effects that that real calories do.
So I read this, Chris, and for a while I was excited. I thought, great, you know, I can just have someone trick me into all of this and I can eat the right foods and not realize and think I'm full. But I do all the shopping and all the cooking for our family. I mean, can these things work for us if we know the truth behind them?
Well, that's hard to say with some of the dietary stuff I just told you. You know, I think so, because sometimes it is the truth behind them. I mean, this what I just told you about is an obvious illusion. But for instance, if you think about some of the metacognitive changes, so let's say you were an athlete preparing for a race, or you're a student preparing for taking the SATs, and you feel clammy hands and your heart beat is raising and you're getting a little sweaty, you can legitimately say that you're getting psyched out, that you're feeling anxiety, that you're going to, and that anxiety is going to hurt your performance. You could also legitimately say that you are getting aroused, you know, you're getting focused, you're going to get psyched up, and this will improve your performance.
Hmm.
Now, if you interpret your jitters one way or the other, in the research that I've seen, the performance follows suit. So it's not necessarily believing a lie, and I can talk about some of the aspects of that in the medical field too, when we get to talking about medical stuff.
Okay, 1-800-933-5372 is our number. I do think we have Leslie back on the line now in Southlake. Hey, Leslie.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have lived in both England and Australia, and there we ran into something which became known to us as the tall poppy syndrome, in which the cultures like to see people who had reached heights fall, and that they'd like to see people cut down, so to speak, to size. So I'm wondering what you've learned about what the impact of cultural attitudes toward individual exceptionalism have to do with an individual's performance.
Interesting question. Thanks, Leslie.
That is an interesting question. You know, and I didn't do too much research into cross-cultural attitudes. Much of it came from, you know, just because the researchers were based in one place or another. You know, the British soccer players are in a unique position. They are certainly not the only players representing a soccer-mad nation. But they do have that unique relationship with their fan base, which is that they have a history of underperforming, and they have the fans are not just fans. The game and the team and their performance is wrapped up in a national identity. So, you know, the players know this; they know their history, and that certainly has a difference. I'm trying to think of other cross-cultural.
Well, I don't know that it's cross-cultural, but it's certainly one thing that you deal with that is sort of external is that you found that teacher expectations can affect student performance regardless of how the student independently feels about himself or herself.
Yeah, well, but it often matters how the student feels about him or herself. This is something called stereotype threat, where it's often the case where a student taking a test who is a member of a group that is often stigmatized as not performing well on this test will be filled with anxiety, and this will hurt his or her performance. So, and it can go the other way, too. So there's a famous study of Asian-American women, college students about to take a math test. So the stereotypes here are that Asians are very good at math, and women struggle in math. So that's the stereotypical expectations. So prior to the test, they were primed to think of their gender or think of their cultural background based on essentially some questions that were put into their demographic survey that they filled out. And then there was a control group that had no such priming. And the test takers who were primed to think of their Asian background performed very well on the test. Compared to the controls, they did better. Mm-hmm. Those who were primed to think of their gender performed below control levels. So I think there is, it does matter what the students themselves actually think, even if they don't believe. It didn't mean that the students there believed that women were not good at math or that Asians were necessarily superior, but they knew that those expectations were out there, and they cluttered their brains.
So we have learned that it's not necessarily a good thing to fill people up with a lot of empty praise and self-esteem they haven't earned. Can you talk about the difference between a fixed mindset and a growth mindset and why it ultimately is better to praise effort than intelligence?
Sure. This is from the research of Carol Dweck, who's a psychologist at Stanford. And essentially, the growth mindset, or the fixed mindset, I'll start with that, basically says that people are born with a set of capacities and strengths and weaknesses. Somebody has an artistic talent or a talent for numbers or not, those sorts of things. And there's not a whole lot. I mean, you can find those talents and develop them or, miss them entirely, and what a shame. But you can't do much to actually change that talent level. That's the fixed mindset. The growth mindset says, in most of these areas, there is always going to be room to define your strengths and weaknesses, to grow. And the basis of that growth is to take on challenges and to fail sometimes. The fixed mindset sees failure as an indication that, well, that's not where my natural talents are, and I should move along mm-hmm. and find out. Because if you have the talent, you're going to be a natural. You're going to, master the basics easily. And so when you praise somebody for, say, hey, you're smart because you did well on this test, then they, rather than saying, you did well on this test because you tried hard, they start thinking of themselves as smart. They don't want to lose that reputation. They don't want to take on something that might be too hard for them now because they'll mess up, and that will disprove this idea that they're smart.
It's like Calvinism almost.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's predestination. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jessica in Southlake. Hey, Jessica.
Hey, Chris. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a registered and licensed dietitian, and you mentioned inquiring about applicable practices in terms of eating habits with some of these studies. And Dr. Painter, I was curious if the author is familiar with some of the studies Dr. Painter has done in terms of plate size and filling that plate full of food and our perceptions of being full from completing those full plates of food, and how that has, it's been used to decrease the amount of calories that people are actually taking in just by varying that plate size and our perception of what we're taking in.
So you mean, Jessica, like a heaping salad size plate as compared with a regularly portioned dinner plate, having the same amount of food, but you feel fuller from the heaping plate?
Essentially, what I do in practice, I recommend that patients not use those dinner plates and use their salad plates to put their food on instead. Our visual perception of the amount of food that we're eating, we want to finish that plate off, not so much eating till we're feeling full. And so when we see that the smaller plate is filled with food versus having a small amount on a very large plate, it's kind of tricking our brains into thinking that when we complete this plate of food, we're going to be full versus actually listening to our hunger and satiety cues.
What do you think about all that, Chris?
Oh, I have read some of that research, and it is fascinating. I'm wondering, did he also do the one with the bowl of soup that kept filling automatically as you ate? It would never kind of decrease, and people would just keep eating it and eating it and eating it.
Exactly.
That's really interesting stuff, and I think it speaks to the same kind of mechanism that the smoothie study had, because people see, you know, the size of what they think they're going to eat, and they expect something out of it, and that informs how full they feel as they eat it. That's great work. I think he did something with popcorn, too, at the movies, but I can't remember the details of it now.
Science journalist Chris Burdick is with us. He is the author of a new book called Mind Over Mind, The Surprising Power of Expectations. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. This hour, our guest is science journalist Chris Burdick, author of the new book Mind Over Mind, The Surprising Power of Expectations. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372. Not surprisingly, Chris, a great deal of this research has explored how the findings here might be applied to help people in the field of medical science. Can you talk a little bit about what's been learned about amputees and phantom pain and expectation?
Sure. So phantom pain is the pain that is associated with what they call phantom limb syndrome. And phantom limbs are experienced by about 90% of people who have lost an arm or a leg. They feel that limb on occasion reform. Often strangely, it's either too short or too long, or it feels like it's contorted in some strange way. It's often very painful. And the sensations and the pain have been known about for centuries, but up until the late 20th century, nobody knew how to really deal with the pain. They would give pain drugs, they would try surgeries, they would snip the remaining nerve endings in the stump of the limb, and nothing really worked. Until a neuroscientist named V.S. Ramachandran in California decided that perhaps the pain was due to a mismatch between the brain's expectations for an intact body and the fact that a limb was missing. So the brain would send a signal for your arm to move in a certain way, and because you had no arm anymore, there would be no proprioceptive or visual feedback confirming that move had been made. And this created this kind of neural confusion that the brain couldn't make sense of and just translated as pain. So he decided to try to see if he could trick the brain into thinking that its expectations of an intact body had been met by using a mirror. He had a patient who had lost an arm in a motorcycle accident. He sat that patient down in front of the mirror, and the patient would move his intact arm in front of it so he could see a reflection that looked like his other arm,
mm-hmm.
move the arm in various, just move the fingers, move the forearm, all the while imagining that he was moving both his arms. He did this for 10 or 15 minutes a day for a couple of weeks, and to everyone's surprise, it worked. He said that his arm reformed, but this time it was under his control, and the pain had diminished. So Ramachandran did this a number of times, I think 10, and it worked 6 out of 10 times. And these kind of existed as case studies until after the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, when more and more soldiers started coming back missing limbs from IEDs. This therapy was finally replicated and put to the test in clinical trials at Walter Reed, I'd say 3 years ago, by a neurologist there named Jack Tsao. So that's the basis of mirror therapy, but it also has implications for those of us who have all of our limbs.
Talk about that.
Sure. It's basically that the idea is that our brain has an expectation for our body, for where we are and how we'll move, and that we have two arms and two legs. Now, when people do immersive virtual reality, they are in a virtual world and they are inhabiting a virtual person called an avatar, and in these labs, the avatar can move in three dimensions. They're tracked in three dimensions so that when you move your arm, your avatar moves your arm. When you look a certain way, your avatar looks that way. And if you approach a mirror in the virtual world and you move in front of it, some part of your brain, the same part of your brain that alleviates the pain in mirror therapy, clicks. You know consciously that this is a computer simulation, but some part of your brain says, okay, that's me. that digital thing is me. And so what they have done, some of these researchers, the one I focus on in the book is Jeremy Bailenson. He's at Stanford. Is they will change the avatar in some subtle and not so subtle ways. So they'll run experiments where some of the avatars are much taller than the people they're talking to. Because there'll be other avatars and what they call agents, which are sort of computer-generated people in these experiments. So sometimes the avatar will be much taller. Sometimes the avatar will be really good-looking or really ugly. They'll vary the age of the avatar. And what they find is that people change how they behave in the virtual world based on what their avatar looks like. And then they find that even after they turn off the virtual world and they put down the goggles and they do a presumably or ostensibly unrelated experiment, the people act differently even when they're back in the brick-and-mortar world. So better-looking avatars will subsequently try for better-looking dates in a dating study that they put on. Taller avatars in the virtual world will be harder negotiators. And then when they come out of the virtual world, again, same thing. They have done studies where the avatars have the subject's face taken from a digital photo but morphed so that the subject is, most of these kids, they're college kids most of the time,
mm-hmm.
So that the subject is now 70 years old, and then subsequently they'll say that, we're going to save more for retirement.
Huh.
So it's basically a virtual way of hacking into self-perception.
And I guess those of us who don't have access to really great-looking avatars can stand in kind of a Superman pose for a few minutes?
Yeah. Now, this is research being done by a group of folks led by Amy Cuddy at Harvard and Dana Carney, who's out in at Berkeley, where... This is okay. So the basis of self-perception theory is that when you meet somebody, some part of your brain is making rapid assumptions about them based on appearance, and they may be overruled later, but you can't help but have these first impressions.
Mm-hmm.
Self-perception theory says that some part of your brain is also doing the same thing for you. You're observing yourself, and you're making certain judgments about yourself based on what you see. So in Amy Cuddy and Dana Carney's work, they said, well, what might you feel about yourself if you looked big? Now, in nature, looking big is always associated with a display of power. I'd say, well, maybe that's it. So what they have is people in off by themselves either stand in expansive poses, like Superman, you know, hands on hips, feet somewhat astride.
Chin held high, yeah.
Chin held high, or hunched poses where, you know, their feet are crossed over one another and they're kind of hunched over and their arms are crossed across their chest. And what they find is that then these people come out and they give them a battery of cognitive tests. They give them choices to make. They sometimes have them do impromptu speeches. And they also test their hormonal levels. They find that in all those three aspects, the effects of having stood and looked big are the same that people find when they are given positions of authority and power. Your cortisol, which is a stress hormone, goes down. Your testosterone goes up. You become more prone to take risks. You become less stressed in general. You think more abstractly. There are all sorts of effects that have been found in other research of, you know, the effects of power. They are made, they are duplicated by standing and looking big in this research.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Plano. We have Zan on the line. Hey, Zan.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Chris, I have a question for you. I sort of have observed that people seem to have this perception that they're lucky, and they seem to be lucky. So is there some relationship that you've observed or that you've studied about luck and what people perceive that to be and how that impacts whether or not they actually do seem to be more lucky than others?
Right. You know, I think from what I've seen, most of the research says that when we think we're lucky, it's an illusion. That a lot of times, especially, you know, I do study gambling in this book. In particular, I look at gambling addicts. And once you kind of cross that threshold from, you know, a recreational gambler to an addicted gambler, a compulsive gambler, what really changes is your perception of randomness and your perception of luck. The compulsive gambler thinks, you know, that he or she controls luck to a certain extent, that sees patterns that aren't there, sees a near miss of a gambling, like in a slot machine, as a sign that he or she is catching on and soon will win, and so continues to bet, whereas a healthier brain might interpret it as what it is, which is a loss. So I haven't seen anything that really says believing you're lucky will make you lucky, with the possible exception that if you believe you're lucky and you are, you know, about to be put to the test in some way, whether it's an academic test or an athletic test, that will take the pressure off, that will relieve the anxiety, and you'll probably do better as a result.
Throw caution to the wind and just get out there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Talk about this. When we refer to the medical effects of placebo and other things like that, we also want to be really careful not to blame the victims of conditions who, for whatever reason, aren't able to want enough or wish enough to have any impact on the state of their physical health.
Yeah, definitely. And I make a point of this in the book, where placebos are very conditional, and they're limited. They are not panaceas. There are certain parts of our health and physiology that they seem to have a significant effect on. There are many parts that they seem to have no effect on. One of them is cancer. There is really no research that has been replicated that shows that positive thinking or imagining your body destroying your tumor or, you know, any kind of mental exercises like that will actually kill the disease and send it into remission. And what happens when you start believing that there is that power, that you can think away your cancer, and then your cancer continues to grow or doesn't shrink, it adds a burden of guilt. You know, who's to blame?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so people have been talking in the cancer care world of the tyranny of positive thinking, which, you know, is essentially saying some things you can't. Your attitude is not going to change, and there are some things that it's a tough enough disease to deal with without, you know, blaming yourself for not having enough, you know, positive vibes to heal yourself.
I think we have time to take one more call here. Let's speak with Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I was calling because I have two children. I'm going to try to be fast. One is has like ADD and learning differences, and the other one is like a straight-A student with no studying. And, you know, the one with ADD and learning differences is always, you know, we've had to make accommodations, and it's always kind of a special thing. And so it's, I'm just wondering, how does that affect her expectations of how she performs on a test and or in life in general, I guess? But, and if that has screwed her up, is there something I can do to help with that?
Any thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think of all the things that I've started thinking differently about since I did this research, it's raising my two kids. I have twins myself, and they're young. And I know that the expectations that we have of our kids, sometimes we're too cavalier in verbalizing them to each other or to even to them. You know, in the case of a child with ADHD, I think that expectations may have less to do with it until perhaps you get to the point of trying to solve it with drugs and to say that this child needs the drugs. And perhaps, is it a daughter or a son? I'm sorry.
I'm not sure we even have time to get to that right now.
Okay.
We've got about 15 seconds to go.
Okay. Well, that, you know, a lot of, I think, kids with learning troubles, you know, it is basically they don't believe that they can do it. They just don't have that belief. But I wouldn't want to diagnose anybody. I certainly am not a doctor.
Science journalist Chris Burdick is a former staff editor at The Atlantic and Mother Jones. His new book is called Mind Over Mind: The Surprising Power of Expectations. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Find out about what we have coming up on kera.org/think. You can email comments, questions, and suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.